Good afternoon to this meeting of Senate Resources Committee. We come to order at 3:35 p.m. Today is Friday, March 20th. Members present today are Senator Rivak, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Machicki. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. In recognition of our current in-person testimony restrictions, I encourage the public to submit written testimony to the committee email address, which is sres@akleg.gov. Our agenda today includes SB 164 forest land use plans, timber sales, HB 16 shared animal and raw milk products, SB 194 advanced nuclear reactors, and under bills previously heard or scheduled, SB 130 seafood product development tax credit. We are going to take SB 130 first. We heard the bill on March 13th, where we had a presentation of the bill and took public testimony. Today is my intention to finish public testimony, take up and discuss an amendment, and look to the will of the committee. With us today to provide a brief statement of the bill is Tim Lampkin, staff to bill sponsor Senator Stevens. Mr. Lampkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Before you is Senate Bill 130, version M, as in Michael. As a general summary of the bill, once again, this is intended to be a truly direct economic development policy that's been used by the state for quite some time, intended also to support the long-term development of Alaska's value-added seafood processing industry, and specifically targeting both the salmon and herring fisheries as well as now the pollock and cod products. Incentive has historically been in the form of a tax credit applied to processors of these fisheries and who invest in infrastructure and R&D to find ways of improving existing or to discover new technologies and adding value to every iota piece of these fish, from the gills to the collagen to the scales, or GCS. With that, Mr. Chairman, we want to thank you again for hearing the bill. There is an amendment that's available to you if you care to discuss that at this time. And it would simply add some additional fisheries, including cod, sole, flounder, rockfish, and perch.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Lampkin. My discussion on the amendment is that we were not going to discuss it today. The reason is I do not have a fiscal note on it. And if this bill has a chance of going anywhere, it better leave this room and go to another one. So we can take up that conversation in another committee, and I'm certainly happy to discuss it with those other members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's not a problem. Thank you for that consideration.
Thank you. Yvette. Any questions for Mr. Lampkin? Seeing none, is there anyone? So public testimony is open. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify on Senate Bill 130? Seeing no one, we have two individuals online. We have Mr. Palmer and Mr. Barrows. Mr. Palmer, do you have any comments you'd like to share with the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We've had incredible support over the years from the state. Our last real critical need was to diversify the product mix of salmon products in Alaska, and the industry successfully did that. We were helped by the state to put that infrastructure in our facilities, and all of that infrastructure exists today. This is kind of the final piece to be able to fully utilize the waste stream. As we face increasing demands from EPA, we have discharge permits in the area of about 10 million pounds per processing plant at our facilities. There's an opportunity to develop economic benefit for the state by reprocessing that and turning that into finished goods and value-added products and nutraceutical and pharmaceutical products that there's already markets for. These are seasonal salmon plants. The industry needs some support to get this infrastructure in place, and we would encourage the Senate to push this along in the process, and we will be able to demonstrate, we think, a very small fiscal note on this, because the biggest infrastructure that would utilize this out in Dutch Harbor already has all this equipment in place. So this is really going to support remote salmon facilities and smaller processing plants around the state.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Can you please identify yourself for the record? We should have started with that, but I didn't catch
sorry.
It.
I'm Mark Palmer. I'm the president and CEO of Ocean Beauty Seafoods. We have 5 processing plants in Alaska, Bristol Bay, Kodiak Island, Prince William Sound, and Southeast.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Palmer? Yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate you being online. I do know we have challenges ahead in the industry. Well, we have had challenges behind. I think they've just been exacerbated. So I hope we can get this bill across the finish line this year. I think it's much needed, particularly this season, but certainly on developing new products for the future.
I agree. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Next, we have Chris Barrows with Pacific Seafood Processing Association. Mr. Barrows, can you identify yourself for the record if you have comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Chris Barrows, and I'm the president of Pacific Seafood Processors Association. And this is actually the second time that I'm in front of you to lend support for Senate Bill 130. So I don't want to take up an inordinate amount of your time, but just to reemphasize, that there's no better way to increase the value of Alaska's resources than to increase the utilization of the fish that has already been harvested. And this has been a proven way to accomplish that in the past with the species of salmon and herring. And given the amount of volume that comes from the cod and the pollock fishery, that's a great return on investment and an appropriate approach to include them. So we applaud both the sponsor and the committee in terms of them taking that up. So with that, I will end my testimony and make myself available if there's any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barrows. That concludes public testimony, which is now closed. Are there any questions for the sponsor? Okay, seeing none, what is the will of the committee? Senator Rivak.
Mr. Chairman, I move SB 130 version 31-LS1197/M from committee with individual recommendations and a task fiscal note.
Any objection? Seeing no objection, the bill moves from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. On the record, next up is Senate Bill 160, Forest Land Use Plans, Timber Sales. Chris Mache, Division of Forestry, will present the bill. Mr. Mache, are you there?
Yes, good afternoon. This is Chris Mache, Director of Division of Forestry. I'm just checking that I'm coming through okay.
Loud and clear, Mr. Mache. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Well, then, for the record, Chris Mache, Division of Forestry, Director. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today on the CS for Senate Bill 160. The overall goal of this legislation is to better support Alaska businesses and communities that depend on state timber sales for economic stability and growth. Removing barriers and improving the timber sale process while allowing for public and community input on proposed projects. I thought what I would do is walk you through the briefing paper that you have, not the whole briefing paper because it's a long one, but I wanted to focus on what the current timber sale process is, and then take you through the bill and highlight the proposed changes that are being made to that timber sale process. Currently, there are four steps, and I'm looking at the briefing paper that's in your packet on page one, that the state has to complete to sell timber. Step one is a regional planning process. There has to be regional plans in place, and if it's in a state forest management plan is also in place before the state can offer timber on lands that are classified for timber purposes. The next step is called the five-year schedule of timber sales. We often call it the FYSTS, but that schedule is basically a notice document that provides notice to both the operators, communities, and the public about planned timber sale activities over a five-year time horizon. We publish these sales every 2 years, or these documents every 2 years, and typically sales that are listed in year one of the forest land use plan are the sales that are going to be up next. So as you go out in time, year one, two, three, four, and five, out at year five, those are roughly 5 years out. We can move sales up. It's not a linear document. We could take a sale that's in year five and move it up to year one, but basically the document serves as notice. The next step is a best interest finding. A best interest finding, of course, is required for the disposal of any state assets, including timber, and that best interest finding process has a preliminary best interest finding that is issued that we take public comment on, including agency comment. We circulate that to other affected agencies for their comment, as well as public comment. And then once we take that into account and make any adjustments that might be needed, a final best interest finding is published. And that is a decision document that is appealable by potentially aggrieved parties. The final step, step four, is we also have to complete what's called a forest land use plan, or a FLUP. That's a more site-specific plan that addresses site-specific actions in the sale, and that document is also an appealable document. And that's one of the key changes that this legislation would make. It would make the forest land use plan not be an appealable document. And I'll go into some more detail on how the FLUP and the BIF interact with each other under the different timber sale authorities that we have. The division has five different timber sale authorities that we can use. I'll start with the first one. These are all called under 3805, then .120. So we often refer to the sales by their shorthand references. So when I say 120, that's the competitive sale authority. So that can be done by sealed bid or oral outcry, and essentially the high bidder on the sale will be awarded the sale and the timber sale contract would be signed. The other suite of authorities we have are various forms of negotiated sale authorities. The first one is the .117 authority, and that's a timber salvage authority, and it's meant for timber that's damaged by bark beetles, insects, fire, and needs to be salvaged quickly. And so it abbreviates some of the processes that we have to go through. And one of those is, for example, those sales do not have to be listed in the five-year schedule of sales. The rest of the authorities we have are also all negotiated sale authorities. The next one is called the 115 authority. That's for small sales under half a million feet that can be for up to 2 years in length and time. The next authority we have is the 118 authority, which is for larger sales over half a million feet. They can be up to 25 years in time. And then the final negotiated authority we have is called the high value added authority. It's a negotiated sale that encourages manufacturing. It's called the 123 authority. And those can authorize sales for up to 10 years in time and can be up to 10 million feet per year in those types of sales. So I know that's a lot of information, and that the briefing paper goes into a lot of detail on that, and I'd be happy to answer questions after I walk you through the legislation and explain what changes we're proposing to make to those sale authorities. Maybe I can pause right here and see if there's any questions about the current process that we have.
Questions for Mr. Mache? Okay, questions about the change, or would you like to walk us through the bill first, Mr. Mache?
I can walk you through the bill if there's no questions on the current process. Okay. So the starting on page one, the first four pages of the bill are current statutory language that is found in 3805-035E. And so the first place that you'll come to an amendment is just conforming language, and that conforming language is changing a reference to a sale type, the 3805-115 sales, to its new location in this proposed legislation under 3805-118. So no substantive change there. That's a conforming change. You can go through page 5 on to page 6, and you'll be in section 2 of the bill. And this is the first section that makes us some major changes to the current best interest finding process. And under the current best interest finding process, it was felt that the criteria to be used for timber sales was relatively undefined. And so we're proposing to add five specific criteria here to this section of the bill. And this will make it a best interest finding more defensible should the bill should the best interest finding be challenged by an aggrieved party, but more importantly, it will allow the department and my agency to address specific conditions that we find that affect how we might pick an authority to sell timber. This will let us address the local timber market for material. It'll let us address specialized or developing foreign or domestic markets. It'll let us address the presence of underutilized timber. And when we say underutilized timber, it means we're not offering the full allowable cut in a given area, so there's excess timber available for offer. The next item is economic constraints of the intended timber market. And then finally, any other reasonable or foreseeable benefits to the state and the local economy from the sale.
Mr.
I'll give you an example of where it would be helpful for us to be able to address the markets for a particular type of material. Be in southeast Alaska with young growth logs that are currently coming online. None of the local mills are able to saw those logs, so the only market for those logs are currently overseas in China. Under our current authority, under 118, we are not able to negotiate a export sale for that type of timber. By adding these criteria to the best interest finding, it would allow us to make that analysis, address the market issue and the economic issue, and then actually offer a sale through a negotiated authority under that kind of a situation.
Mr. Mache,
really just one example of how that would give us more flexibility in the best interest finding process.
Mr. Mache,
move on. Yes,
you've got to give me a little gap there in between sections. Mr. Mache, you're talking about, you're discussing things in the CS. So just give us a moment to adopt the CS as the working document, please, if we're going to discuss it. We were looking at the original bill, and it's become apparent.
I apologize.
Okay. Or Senator Rivak, do you have a motion for me?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 163-1-GS-2170/M before us as our working document.
And I will object so Mr. Mache can continue discussing the CS. Okay, continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we were just looking at Section 3. This is on page 6 of the bill on line 11. This makes just some language changes, but it also there, you will note, increases a threshold of from 10 acres to 20 acres in terms of the applicability of this section. And this section is essentially saying the department may not permit the harvest of timber in a harvest unit until a site-specific plan is in place. And again, that site-specific plan is the forest land use plan. However, we can offer the timber for sale and sell it under the best interest finding, but the FLEPs do have to be completed before timber harvest can actually take place in the units. Going on to section 7, or page 7, excuse me. You see under section 5 that there's a deletion in that section. That's language that would not apply with the proposed changes for the negotiated sales. On to section 6, that is conforming language changes to the references of where the new small 115 sales will occur. On to section 7, for sales greater than 500,000 board feet or equivalent, this addresses the notice of intent to negotiate. And again, just to reiterate, right now the negotiated sales are small negotiated sales under 500,000 board feet up to 2 years. Those are targeted at very small operators. Really, the mid-size sales are the high value added, the 1-2-3 sales that target sales of 10 years and 10 million feet per year, and then the very large sales over 500,000 feet that can be for up to 25 years. Moving on to Section 9, this section is under the High Value Added Authority currently. There's some conforming language there on line 3, and line 6 adds a definition of other value-added wood products. That term is already defined in regulation as well as high-value wood products. It's a list of the types of products that fall under those two categories. And those are the categories of material that are available that a mill has to produce to qualify for a 1-2-3 sale. moving on, Section 10 deletes some language that is currently in the 1-2-3 authority, and that's to make this authority more efficient. There's a 7 criteria currently that has to be addressed in the 1-2-3 authority that is very cumbersome, and so we're proposing to remove all 7 criteria. Section 11, again, is conforming language, and then the last page, page 9, is just when the legislation would take effect. So to sum up, in summary, this legislation is designed to provide a consistent and flexible timber sale program to support the range of domestic mills, that's the small individual mills to large mills, and to encourage further development of offshore markets for logs and manufacturing opportunities for forest products in the state. Again, I want to stress the key change that is made is making the forest land use plans a non-appealable document. And I said I would give you an example of how that's a problem. When we do one of these longer term sales, be it a 120 sale or a 118 sale, we only write the FLUPs for 5-year increments. So if a timber sale is sold that's for 25 years, it means it's going to have a series of 5 different FLUPs written over the course of the sale. And under current statute, someone could appeal each of those FLUPs. So you essentially would get multiple bites at the apple, if you will, if you are not in support of a particular action that the state has taken. So under this bill, just the best interest finding would be the appealable document, and the FLUP would not. So I'll pause there and see if there might be any questions from members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Mache. Questions? Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mache, for being online today with us. I do have a question about the best interest finding that I know what a typical best interest finding requires. In Section 2 of the bill, you've added a series of items. Are all those items equally weighted?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that's a good question. I think it says the terminology there is by considering, so it means it gives us broad discretion in how we address that. They're not necessarily equally weighted. In fact, we may only address one or two of those specifically. So in the example I gave with the young growth timber, that's market-driven, so we would address the market part of that, which would be a specialized or developing foreign market or domestic market, item 3 there. And we would also talk about the economic constraints of that timber, because it's currently no one can process timber in-state because the value of the log is higher in China. So in that case, we might only address two of those reasons as to why we chose a particular sale authority to use.
Follow-up, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The second question I have is on number six, item six, it says any other reasonably foreseeable benefit to the state or local economy resulting from the sale. That seems like a pretty big open statement. If it says any other reasonable, something that could be there that's not in the best interest finding, though. Am I just reading that right, or is there some term of art that's being used in that?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, it is very broad and flexible. And I might ask, I do have Chris Orman available. He's a representative from the Department of Law. And Department of Law looked very carefully at these criteria and made some of these specific recommendations. So I might ask if he could help address that particular question.
Mr. Orman.
So Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, this is Christopher Orman, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. To address that question, so the five criteria that are under Section 2 of this CS that you're looking at, the fifth one actually was taken from what is currently 3805123D7. So D7 reads, any other reasonably foreseeable benefits to the state and local economies from the sale. So it's language that's been preserved from D7 with then the changes to that provision in this draft to 123. As far as that language and, you know, from a legal standpoint, just kind of the legal answer to that, It is broad. It is general. Previously, that language was not in 110. And the reason to have this language and these factors in 110 is to make it clear that if the commissioner is choosing a certain means of sale, a type of sale, that it's not an arbitrary decision that's being made, that there's a certain focus and a certain reason for choosing, say, a 120 sale, which would be, you know, a competitive process versus a negotiated sale under 118 or a 123 sale, for that matter. So that language is somewhat broad. It has its basis from 123 currently, and I think part of it is to, again, acknowledge that there's the possibility and the likelihood of certain factors and focus that's going to be needed and flexibility when considering the best interests of the state. I'll also note that when thinking about these factors and how they're going to be considered, they are going to be considered in the context of a best interest finding. So the means of sale and the type of sale is going to be based on what's in the best interest of the state. You could probably imagine, and I'll allow Mr. Mace to explain this, but to the extent it's needed, but you know, there could be a reason for a competitive sale over a negotiated sale. And so some of these factors and some of that flexibility will need to be to exist there. I'll also note, as far as then going back and thinking about it in the context of a best interest finding, the protections to the public then exist there, because the public still can then challenge the best interest finding, or those that are affected and have an appeal process through the best interest finding. So that may not answer. I hope that answers the question, and let me know if it did. If not, it can obviously maybe mine it further for you.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being online. I guess that I'm reading Section 2 of the bill, and it says the sale can be offered under multiple provisions, and then it says by considering the best interest finding on best interest of the state, and then this list of five other categories. Can the sale of timber be offered under just one of those exclusively, but not in the best interest of the state, which is number one under that section?
Oh, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, I understand your question. I apologize. So Under each sale provision is the requirement for a best interest finding. So some of this language here may not be as – it may be clunkier than we would want, but the idea is that a sale under any of the provisions, and if you look under 118, 120, 123, it requires a best interest finding. So there still need to be a best interest finding. What really is happening here is that currently under 110, there is language that allows the commissioner – to choose the method. And just like looking at the language right now, 110C says, if the sale of timber may be offered under multiple provisions of 3805.110 through 123, the commissioner shall determine the applicable provisions under which to offer the timber, and then that's it. There's no real analysis or factors to consider which is going to decide which form and which means of sale it should take, why it should be a competitive process versus, say, a negotiated sale, why it should be a 123 process versus an, you know, 118 process. So the idea here is that if there's going to be negotiated sales or competitive sales, to have a list of factors that are going to be addressed that are going to then provide guidance as far as which type of sale provision is appropriate. So it's trying to remove some of the arbitrariness that currently, I think, exists in 110 within the changes to 118 and 123. I hope that answers your question.
A little bit clearer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. Other questions? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have, I guess, to start off with maybe a more technical question. I'm not sure I understand the interplay of Section 7 and 8, and I'm probably missing something that's easily explained, but Section 7 sure seems to suggest that you don't have to give notice. You only have to give notice if you're going to do more than a half a million board feet, but then Section 8 sure seems to say that within a year of that, you can do another almost half a million board feet. So are we doing a million board feet or 999,000? Or how's that work?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Keel, you're looking at Section 7 and 8 in the bill, and the new language is just specifying that for a sale greater than a half million board feet, for all sales of that size, we have to do notice, and actually it's the 945 notice. And then Section 8 is current statutory language, and says that for sales in the amounts equal or less than half a million board feet or equivalent or other measure are exempt from requirements of 3805.15.150. So I'm not sure I completely understand your question, to be honest, but we can't offer a sale for more than 500,000 feet without notice. And for that matter, even the smaller sales have a notice process.
Mr. Orman, could you restate? You gave a number for a statute that was had a few more digits than usual.
Sorry, are you still there?
Yes. So you said that are exempt from the requirements. I think you said 3805.15.150.
Oh. So, Senator Machicki, let's see. I probably was speaking too fast as usual. Was that as far as my response to Senator Kawasaki?
No, as far as your recent response to Senator Keel.
Oh, so I haven't responded yet to Senator Keel. That was Mr. Mache that responded.
I apologize for that, Mr. Mache.
I can respond maybe and provide some clarification if it'll help.
That would be helpful. Yeah. Your voices are somewhat similar, more so than usual.
Oh, well, I'll take that as a compliment, Senator Machicki. So
I'm sorry, this is Chris Mache here. We're having some technical difficulties. I was kind of cut out there for the last few minutes, so I didn't hear what was happening.
So going back to Senator Keel's question, so through the chair, when as to Section 7, 3805.118B, you're correct. This would be, as far as public notice within 3805 or at pursuant to 3805.945, not requiring that public notice for small timber sales. So currently under 115, 3805.115, there's a provision, I believe it's an A, that says it is an A, that says without advertisement. So the general idea here is that you're not required to follow through with notices required under 3805945. Now, as Senator Keel probably knows, under the Alaska Constitution, though, there are still notice requirements. And so I think that Mr. Mace is referring to the fact that even though it's a small timber sale, there's still going to be notice requirements that have to be met. It's simply not going to be the level of 3805945. As far as then Section D, the first line would allow for more negotiated sales and additional sales within a year. Mr. Mace can kind of then reference that. So it's a bit of a different, I think, issue. B is discussing notice. D is discussing negotiated sales and pursuant to the amount of board fee that's at issue. If that, hopefully that provides some clarification.
Senator Keel?
Mr. Chairman, I've heard a couple things, and I apologize that I don't have all the cross-reference statutes in front of me. I probably should have brought the books. I guess that when I read these two next to each other, it kind of looks like we can call it a 499,000 board foot sale, wink at each other, and within a year it's a million without an additional notice. And I guess I don't understand what keeps that from happening.
So Senator, I'm sorry. I don't know who you would like to respond to that.
Well, when you do respond, please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, sir. Sorry. This is Chris Foreman, Department of Law. Senator Keel through the chair, and Mr. Mace can probably explain this better as far as the nuts and bolts, but again, I just want to be very, very clear. No matter the size of the sale, notice has to happen. There has to be public notice. Now, whether or not it's 3805945 notice, which is more, you'll see there's three or four requirements for notice, or it's notice through some other avenue, there needs to be notice. Now, if it doesn't have to follow or meet the standards of 3805945, that notice still needs to address and be sufficient enough that it meets certain procedural due process standards. So legally, it needs to reach the appropriate affected people. So the methods that are used still need to address and reach the people that are required pursuant to the Constitution. So I'm only going to provide that clarification as far as maybe the more, like I said, the kind of on the ground and actually how this is going, how this functions. I'll provide or allow Mr. Mace to fill in.
So can I, let me just clarify if I can in my understanding. Section 7 says that an amount greater than 500,000 board feet requires a 3805-945 notice. Within the year, in Section 8, you can negotiate additional timber sales for an amount greater than 500,000 board feet. And all it says is if the amount is less than an additional 500,000 barrels, but there's the lesser notification requirement.
Mr. Chair, this is Chris Mace, speaking, Director of the Division. I think you summed it up well. If we were going to negotiate additional board footage to Senator Keel's question, we would have to go back through and do a best interest finding to do that. So it's not that we could just all of a sudden add another 500,000 board feet to a sale that had been negotiated in a prior sale. And it's very rare that we would do that. Most of our timber sales we sell through a competitive process using the 120 authority. There are reasons where we do want to negotiate sales, and usually that's to help support local manufacturing and sawmills and manufacturing that's occurring already in the state. So a lot of these negotiated authorities are not a common way for us to sell timber, but it is a way we can sell timber.
Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's helpful. There may be a typo here at page 8, line 1. I'm not sure that's the reference we mean, I can move on to another topic if you're ready for another topic, Mr. Chairman.
If there's a typo that's citing existing statute, I think we should point it out on the record.
It's a reference to 3415150, which has to do with execution of conveyances, which may not.
Mr. Orman?
Mr. Chair, I believe that is correct the way it is, and I'm looking in the statute book right now to see that reference. I'll have to get back with you on that, but I believe that it comes from current statute, so it would have to be a typo that's in current statute if it is.
Okay, we would like some follow-up, and we're obviously going to hold the bill today, but you hear the questions around those particular sections in 7 and 8. Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, sir.
On a different topic within the bill, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly.
So going to maybe more of the heart of the bill, the notion that the forest land use plans would no longer be something that could be appealable. I guess I understand the argument about not wanting to give somebody four or five bites at the apple over the course of a sale. I get that. The thing that is, I guess, concerning to me is that a FLUP, a land use plan, I have a hard time saying FLUP, the forest land use plan does different things than a best interest finding, and they are things that seems to me are of interest to Alaskans. I had it in front of me a minute ago, but the site and the size and the timing of the harvest methods, the requirements for access, reforestation. So, I mean, those are things Alaskans generally want some input in, and for that input to be meaningful, it's hard for me to see Alaskans having confidence in that if there's no appeal to that. Can you help me with the how a best interest finding covers those things that I guess matter to people?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator. Yes, the best interest finding addresses many of the same topics, but the forest land use plan, if you will, bores down into more detail because we are out in the woods doing the final layout, putting the road locations in, but you have to remember that these areas have also been addressed by an area plan and if they're in a state forest management plan, which has had a lot of public process in those planning documents. It provides the overall strategic guidelines, if you will, for how reforestation will be done, how roads will be built. We have to meet the minimum standards of the state's Forest Resources and Practices Act, which provides all kinds of guidelines and best practices for the variety of forest practices that the FLUP addresses. And then perhaps the most important thing about the FLUP, we're just proposing to change the appeal piece of it. We still will circulate a FLUP to affected agencies, and that's typically DEC, for the water quality piece, and to Alaska Department of Fish and Game for fish habitat, but also, to the Habitat Division. And then we also will still take public comment on the FLUP and consider that comment in the process of crafting the final FLUP.
Mr. Chairman, over the years, I've certainly heard Alaskans ask for the opportunity to comment on the fish habitat permits, which are not subject to public comment, much less appeal. And one of the reasons Fish and Game is given for not taking public comment on those is, especially with regard to timber sales, is that most of the concerns about that habitat can be addressed in the details of the sale when the FLUP is, Forest Land Use Plan is subject to comment. So the arguments get a little recursive here, and I'm a little concerned about Alaskans' role in the process. So I guess the question would be why do the forest land use plan? If you've got the area plan and the best interest finding and they cover everything we're worried about, do we still need this thing at all?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, there are places of the state where there is not and any of the higher level planning documents. And in those cases, the forest land use plan can serve as the guiding plan guidance, if you will. For those areas. An example would be out in Galena, we did a sale there to help support the forest biomass project that's in that community. It's a wood chip boiler. And in order for the state to sell the timber sale on state land, you have to have some type of planning level document. So the FLUP does serve as that planning level document if no higher level plan does occur.
Senator? Okay, any other questions? Thank you. We have also online for testimony Tessa Axelson with the Alaska Forest Association. Tessa, please identify yourself for the record and give your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tessa Axelson. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Forest Association, or AFA. AFA is pleased to testify today in support of CFSB number 160. Just by way of background, AFA is an industry support organization, and we're dedicated to promoting the interests and needs of Alaska's forest products industry. Director Mache has covered many of the benefits that we see in a summary of the bill, so if I might, I'd just like to cover three primary benefits and conclude with why those benefits are of such importance to AFA and our members and industry at this point in time. So first and foremost, the bill provides the State of Alaska's Department of Natural Resources, and specifically the Division of Forestry, with the ability to negotiate sales with any user of timber resources. Secondly, the bill does away with the ability to appeal what we've referred to as a FLUP, which in turn allows the State of Alaska to conduct timber sales more efficiently without compromising environmental review and public comment requirements and processes that exist through other planning components, as stated. And finally, the bill provides the State of Alaska with the ability to offer small volume timber sales with greater efficiency. Overall, what AFA would offer to you all for your consideration is that this bill provides an opportunity to address current challenges with timber sale processes and authorities. And these matters are of particular interest to AFA and its members for many reasons. What I'd like to share with you are four of those primary reasons currently. The Alaska timber industry is reliant, as I know you all are aware, on a predictable timber supply, and that supply comes from a variety of landowners. That includes the State of Alaska's Division of Forestry. And in recent years, limitations on sales by our federal landowners, in this case we're referring to the U.S. Forest Service, the transitions from old growth or OG to young growth or YG that was detailed under the 2016 U.S. Forest Tongass Land Management Plan, and prevailing market conditions in China and Asia, including the COVID-19 pandemic and existing tariffs on Alaska timber, necessitates each of the benefits of this legislation. AFA looks forward to the process as it moves forward. We stand in support of SB 160 as currently authored, and be pleased to take any of your questions.
Thank you for your testimony today. Any questions for Ms. Axelson? Seeing none, thank you for being here today and for your testimony. I'm now going to open public testimony on SB 160. Is there anyone in the room? I see no one online that would like to testify on SB 160. Okay, seeing no one, we're going to hold public testimony open. And I'm going to remove my objection on the CS. So the CS is before the committee. I'm going to hold public testimony open, and we will set this bill aside. Next up, we have HB 16, Shared Animal and Raw Milk Products, sponsored by Representative Tarr. The sponsor has submitted a blank CS, making a few changes, but until we've had the presentation on the bill, it's not been distributed. Here to present the original bill is Representative Tarr. Online, we have her staff, Carla Hart. Good afternoon, Representative.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm Representative Garen Tarr from District 19 in Anchorage. Thank you to the other committee members for the opportunity. Excited to present this bill. I think in the context of everything that's going on, we're thinking about economic development opportunities as well as food security. So I think this bill addresses both of those issues. It's pretty simple in nature, and we have Susie Crosby should be online as an invited testifier, and she has a brief PowerPoint presentation. So I want to defer to her for most of the time that we have today. But just want to refresh members' sort of memories to what we have right now in Alaska is that we allow raw milk through herd share programs. And unfortunately, it's limited to just the fluid milk products, and that eliminates some opportunities for value-added products like cheese, ice cream, butter, or yogurt. And so this bill would open up that opportunity for the folks participating in the herd share program. This is sort of just taking the smallest step forward. If you look in your packet, there's a document from the National Conference of State Legislatures. I believe it's still in there. It is in the packet. Thank you. And you can see across the country, there's sort of a spectrum. So the most restrictive would be no sharing or selling of raw milk in any way. But we are sort of on that most restrictive side of things because we allow it just through the herd share programs. But across the country, you know, as it gets less restrictive, there are some states that allow sale at farmers markets, for example. This does not go that far. And then the most permissive are the states that allow the sale of raw milk in retail stores, and this does not go that far at all. And in fact, most of the western states are on with the more liberalized policies. So we're, you know, sort of just taking one step, one incremental step forward, and want to be mindful of any safety concerns. So one of the reasons we feel comfortable about this is that through these herd share programs, you have a kind of a closed loop system. So you know where the product is coming from, you know who's getting it, and when Susie talks, she can talk to you a little bit about how she manages her own herd. But having been to her farm and knowing these small scale operations, it's pinpointed from every point in the process. So not just that you would know even what goat, but it was probably Betty the goat or Jasper the goat or whoever, because they all have even names. So, you know where it came from, you know what product, when it was made, who had that. So you can very quickly address if there were ever a safety concern. I think for me, if that's enough for the opening comments, and then want to, if I could turn to Ms. Crosby, and then I'd be happy to take any other questions now or afterwards. But I think her presentation will help just show you the hands-on piece of it, and I'd be happy to press the button as we're sitting here.
Okay. Before I go to Ms. Crosby, do we have any questions for Representative Tarr? Seeing none. Such a good job. We're going to go right to Ms. Crosby. Ms. Crosby, if you can identify yourself for the record and move through your presentation whenever you're ready.
Hi, this is Susie Crosby, representing Cottonwood Creek Farm. And thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the opportunity to talk to you today. So, Rep. Tarr, if you have that PowerPoint ready to go.
I do, and just tell me when to move the slides, and I will.
Okay, so you're probably looking at the title screen. That's the business end of our goats, and you can flip. So why herd share? Well, it's legal in Alaska in a restricted sense of fluid milk only. Goats help pay their way. They help pay for their food, and we've got a lot of people here locally who do want to eat local, locavores. And there's a number of people for whom goat milk is digestible, where store-bought pasteurized cow milk is not. and then why goats? We'll gloss over that one pretty quickly. But we're very fond of goats. They're a great little homestead animal that is a good size to work with. They've been referred to as the missing link between pets and livestock. They have great personalities, easy to keep. You can go ahead and flip to the next. What herd share is... It is legal. There's a reference to the document on the DECAlaska.gov website. Currently allows fluid milk only. It is a sustainable, it's kind of like a CSA, community-supported agriculture. And it's distributed with a scheduled weekly pickup, a commitment, which is formalized in a signed bill of sale and herd share agreement with each individual's contact information. And it is able to be somewhat tailored to the individual. They can pick and choose the amount of milk that they would like to get per week. But the money that they're spending monthly to support that is being paid as a boarding fee. It's not being paid as buying milk. If anybody has questions, just stop me and we'll answer a question. So what herd share is not? It's not the grocery store. Fred Meyer's doesn't care if you walk in there one day and buy 10 gallons of milk and then don't come back again for 3 weeks. Herd share is very dependent on people picking up their milk on the same schedule as the goats are producing the milk. And it's certainly not selling milk. People don't come over and slap down money and walk away with milk. It has to be by agreement and with contact info. And it's not making cheese or other products for herd share members yet. But HB 16 would open the door for value-added products while still staying within that safety net of the closed-loop system that Representative Tarr mentioned. So a little bit about how we manage our milking, the safety and sanitation. Next slide. Milking location. I've heard people talk about, well, you have to have a really clean barn. It's like, no, you don't milk goats in the barn. That's where the goats live. Goats are not good housekeepers. You take the goats away from the barn and bring them down to a location that is can be sanitized and do everything there, and then when they're done, they go back to their barn. So we do a pre-milking spray. I'm very emphatic about whenever anybody is a helper for us, we wash hands a lot. Our milking parlor is in our basement, so fortunately we have hot running water in unlimited supply, and it's easy to keep washing hands every time you go from touching animals to touching food. The part two, the milk is milked in through the lines into the canister that you see there. Then it's filtered into pre-chilled jars, weighed, and put into rapid cooling. I always educate new folks about we like to draw a sharp dividing line between poop and food, and anything that's touched the milk stand isn't going to touch the counter. So rapid chilling is essential for good shelf life and good product quality. On to part three. We keep really really strong, really good records. If you can see in that picture, there's a number on each jar that tells me which pair of goats it's from. And I then transfer that information on each day's packing so that I know if somebody comes to me that week says, well, my milk had an off flavor, I know exactly which two goats to check on. And we work on educating the share owners. Part of their herd share agreement is how to take care of your raw milk. We sanitize the jars before they go back out into use again. And I had the opportunity this week, we've all talked for years and years about, well, food security in Alaska, what if the supply lines were cut for some reason? And who knew that something like a pandemic could cause people to go into the stores and do such panic buying that they would even empty the stores of dairy products. And I went into a store up here in the Mat-Su Valley day before yesterday, and there was not a container of milk on the entire dairy section cooler. And came back home and packed coolers for our herd share folks, and each one of them got the exact amount that they expected, and it was waiting for them with their name on it. So what a graphic illustration of the value of herd share in this current health crisis. So benefits of House Bill 16 for consumers, it would give people a variety of options besides fluid milk only. If somebody wanted, say for example, somebody's leaving town for 3 weeks and then they're going to come back and have some milk credit. If they could have the opportunity to choose yogurt or kefir or cheese or even ice cream instead of the plain milk, it would give them better options. Again, the goat products are a digestible option for a lot of people who have allergies to store-bought milk. A number of our herd share members are in that category. And although some of them like to get their milk and make their own products, make their own cheese or yogurt or whatever, the vast majority would prefer to just have them ready-made and available. It also gives people an opportunity to get specialty cheeses that are not even available in stores at any price. And consumers really love to be able to have unique locally made artisan food. Precedents for HB 16 are already set in Wyoming in particular. Tennessee allows value-added products. South Dakota also allows products. Missouri, Maine, those are some of the states that whose examples it would be great if Alaska would be able to follow with HB 16. So flip into the next slide. HB 16 would allow value-added products like feta. Next slide, queso fresco. Next slide, Chev. That's several different Chev flavors there. to be a legal component of a herd share agreement. And the benefit of that for producers is, I mean, the value added. You're, each gallon of milk is going to buy you an extra bale of hay, for example. Also, the lactation curve of each individual goat, but the herd in general, is going to be high in the summer, low in the winter, kind of follows our daylight curve. And in the summer, when you have all that seasonal surplus, it is wonderful to be able to put it into cheese and then freeze that for later use. It freezes beautifully. And that way you'd have specialty products available when production is at its lowest in the winter, because goats like to eat every day, not just when they're milking. They even eat when they're dried up. And that safety net of two-way communication between producer and consumer would remain unchanged. House Bill 16 would not enable product sales at markets. It would still be that herd share. And next slide. This is just a picture that I took. We were celebrating the new year with eggnog and some homemade chocolate goat cheese truffles. And next slide, from the goats at Cottonwood Creek Farm. Next slide. Thank you for considering House Bill 16. And next slide, come to the farm after COVID-19 is over.
Thank you, Ms. Crosby. That was extremely informative. I won't comment about the dog at the beginning. I was wondering if you got a photo release from the guarding the dogs at the beginning. But thank you for that presentation. Questions for Ms. Crosby?
I would just commenting on the dog. I would have expected the goats to be on top of the building.
You'd think. I think she took her lessons from the goats.
Well, I think it's an important bill, and I appreciate you bringing it forward. Do we have any questions for Ms. Crosby or Representative Tarr? Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess to whomever is the better one to answer, and that is the food safety question. There were elements in the presentation about folks who aren't able to digest or consume products from the grocery store, but some of the And in fact, I have a family member who, for a long time, had to be goat's milk, couldn't be cow. But some of the immune-compromised folks were mentioned also particularly susceptible to foodborne illnesses. And so absent pasteurization, can you address specifically whether these value-added products, like cheeses, are potentially a higher risk for some of the pathogens that can be found in dairy operations?
I'll start out, and then Ms. Crosby, if you want to go after me, through the chair to Senator Keel. The important part is all of what was shown in the slides in terms of the handling of the milk and making sure, the transfer in terms of the refrigeration and the chilling. So as long as that process is done anything that's made for it shouldn't be any more high risk than the fluid milk itself. It's more about the handling, as I understand it, and that's why I want to have Ms. Crosby add in. But just historically, one thing for all of us to know is that really the reason we transitioned to the system we have today isn't because the products became unsafe. It's because we used to live close to the farms where we got the food that we ate. And then as farming became more rural and people became more urban, pre-refrigeration, what was happening is then the milk was traveling over long distances, and then people were getting sick. And so it's really, the practice in terms of how you handle the product is the most important thing. And so, a whole system, now we have pasteurized milk as a result of that. But again, it wasn't because anything about the safety of the milk product changed. It was because lifestyles changed, and before refrigeration, then that created an unsafe situation. So just historically, I think it's interesting for us to kind of understand that, because now, if you eliminate that same problem where you're close to the producer of the food and you've eliminated any travel or distance and you've properly handled it, then the safety concerns can be addressed.
Senator Keel, follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really not particularly, I'm not opposed to the bill, but I'm curious, right? When we talk about making cheese, often those are moderate temperature processes, and involve coagulants and fermentation and additional containers. And so we have additional steps. And do we have, I mean, what is the likelihood there with that additional step of time and additional handling? Can you talk about comparative risks?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, that is not something that has come up as a strong concern. I don't have sort of like statistical information, if you will, that would support that there is a higher risk. And so that was something that we had looked into before, but that there's not, you know, based on sort of like if you compare to other states' policies, there's not an indication that it's higher risk to do the value-added products. There hasn't been any increase in illness or anything that would lead you to believe that that those products were higher risk. Does that help?
Senator Keel, we will have DEC here the next time we see the bill. So I think we can ask those questions to the department directly.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, if I could, Ms. Crosby might be able to just explain a little bit about the handling piece of it that might help illustrate that a little bit more, if that would be okay.
Ms. Crosby?
Yes. One of the chapters in that story of how milk went from being raw from the farm to pasteurized 100 years ago was that as people became more urban, one of the workarounds that they did was to bring cows into the cities and figure that feeding them the swill from the breweries was going to be a great way to have milk right there in the cities. And the swill dairies were notorious for being filthy, and a lot of disease came from that situation, and that just exacerbated the issue of why milk became a pasteurized product. So, of course, any raw milk dairy, realizing that they're handling a fragile raw product, needs to be extremely vigilant with regards to sanitation, which we certainly are. Everything goes through sanitized. Everything's sanitized in the dishwasher before use. The milk only touches glass and stainless steel. And if I make cheese, I'm as meticulous about my processes upstairs as I am downstairs during the milking time.
Senator Keel.
Thank you.
Yes. Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. I guess this would be for Ms. Crosby or whoever wants to answer. When you have the agreement to sell raw milk as a person who's sharing ownership in an animal, do they have to be – is there anything that you have to sign? Do you have to sign a waiver? Do you give them information ahead of time to sort of educate the public? And is that part of – is that within regulation that you must do that, or – is it not that you don't have to do it? And then I guess I have a second question on liability.
Okay, so the first question through the chair to Senator Kawasaki. The DEC statement says, however, a legal contract needs to be established clarifying ownership of the animal. That's part of their herd share document. And, yes, we have a two-part signature page on the back of a several-page herd share agreement that is a great deal of information and instruction to people as far as this is how we do things and this is how you should handle the milk that we take so much care with. So the top section is a bill of sale and the bottom section is a herd share agreement. And yes, there is a spot where they initial that they have read and agree to the terms of the agreement. One line of which says that they have done their own research regarding the safety of raw milk and are willingly choosing to drink it.
And just a follow-up.
Follow-up, Senator.
And is that so that is a requirement within state law or state regulations?
It's a requirement of the regulation. This is what the raw milk share document from the DEC currently reads. It says, it is legal to remove cow, sheep, or goat milk from a premise for personal consumption if the person owns the animal. However, a legal contract needs to be established clarifying ownership of the animal. So that's what our signature page on our herd share contract does. It establishes the clarifying ownership and the share ownership of the animal.
That's excellent. And I think people sort of know what they're getting into, and I appreciate that you provide that information to folks who may just not know before they buy. Thank you.
Right. And we don't consider it our job to really crusade for the benefits of raw milk. Our clientele is the people who've already done their own homework and have arrived at their own conclusion, and then we're happy to accommodate them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Chairman, pardon me.
One moment, please. Ms. Crosby, would you be willing to share that information with the committee on what that agreement looks like?
Yes, I could email that. How would you like me to share that?
Emailing to me would be fine, and I can share it with the committee. The email address is SRES@AKLEG.gov.
SRES@AKLEG.gov. Okay, SRES@AKLEG.gov. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
I can have that off to you in a minute.
Other questions? And I think those are important questions for DEC as well, just to learn how they and you had a follow-up, Representative Tarr.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And pardon me, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was going to say we had a sample of a herd share agreement in the packet. And thank you, Ms. Crosby, if she's willing to share hers. We just used a sample one in the interest of sort of protecting her business. But if she's willing to share it, I'm not going to, you know, stand in the way. But that's why it's the sample one. It is not an Alaska-based business.
Thank you, Representative. We do have a giant Cottonwood Creek Farm ad placement in front of us, so I think Ms. Crosby might be comfortable with that. But if there are no other questions, a couple of points that I just wanted to make. One is I serve on a lot of committees, and I don't know if I've heard a bill in the last week that wasn't somehow related to the COVID-19 situation, but in this case, it actually fits. We have a food security issue. In many of the others, it perhaps was a stretch. We grew 50% of our food 60 years ago, and I think we're 4% today. And we are exposed. And if Canada is shut down for commerce or other issues occur, I would like to see us be a lot more not only food secure, but take advantage of those employment opportunities here in the state of Alaska. So I appreciate you bringing it forward. Did you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, Ms. Crosby, I'll go real quick. And then if you want to say something.
The only thing I would like to say is just thank you to all of you for supporting local Alaskan agriculture.
Thank you, Ms. Crosby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to say that, to me, agriculture is the good news story coming out of Alaska. There was the agriculture census last year that showed that we've got a lot more growth in this industry than other states, more veteran farmers and more women farmers. So it's a huge opportunity for our economy, which is something I know we're all thinking about right now, and the food security piece. So I do really appreciate your time among the other many issues that people are trying to work through and deal with right now, that you would bring this bill before you. And if we can provide any additional information, please let us know. We'll be happy to do that.
So, okay, and my understanding is that you have submitted a blank CS, and we can bring that up at the next meeting.
Okay.
And cover the changes. And I'm going to open public testimony. I don't believe there's anyone here to testify on HB 16. There is not anyone online. Is there anyone in the room? We will keep it open for the next meeting. And with that, we're going to put this bill aside.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. We have 12 minutes. Do you want to do an intro of? Yes. Okay. We're going to do an intro of Senator Bishop's bill. That is Senate Bill 194, Advanced Nuclear Reactors, sponsored by Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee. Sorry about that. It's not a personal bill. And here we have Cody Grusendorf to start the presentation. We'll get as far as we can, but it's 11 minutes that we don't have to use for the next meeting, so we'll be further along. Thank you, Cody.
For the record, Cody Grusendorf, staff to Senator Bishop and the Community Regional Affairs Committee. I can just speak briefly to what the bill does, and then we can allow our invited testifier, Mr. Nickel from Nuclear Energy Institute, to speak to the bill, if that's all right with you.
That's okay. Thank you.
So, brief introduction to the bill. Senate Bill 194 is seeking to ensure that advanced nuclear reactor applications in Alaska receive the appropriate level of state oversight when being considered for consideration in the Alaska market. Current state statutes allow for development of this of nuclear energy source in Alaska, and currently the statutes provide a tremendously high and thorough level of oversight by the administration and by the legislature, on top of already thorough regulation and oversight from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which has governance over the entire nation's nuclear activities. This bill has two parts. The first part is it defines what advanced nuclear reactors are, and it the second part is it reduces barriers to entry while leaving in the thorough regulatory process. SB 194 would only apply to advanced nuclear reactors, which use state-of-the-art safety mechanisms. They have no moving parts, and they will never melt down. These are very safe. It's a very safe technology, and the next testifier will speak to that. Current statutes require that any nuclear facility in Alaska be sited on land designated by the legislature by law. And what this bill essentially does is it exempts that requirement for advanced nuclear reactors, which was defined in this bill under 300 megawatts. And that is a very brief introduction to the bill. And if we could go to the invited testimony, that would be.
That's perfect. Thank you, Mr. Grusendorf. Any quick questions before we go to Mr. Nickel? Mr. Nickel, if we don't get through your presentation today, I promise to come back to it in a following meeting shortly. Let's get as far as we can. So please identify yourself for the record and start your presentation.
Thank you. For the record, this is Marcus Nickel from the Nuclear Energy Institute. I'm the Senior Director for New Reactors. Moving on to slide two. The key point here is that advanced reactors are maturing rapidly, and they could be deployed in Alaska soon. So if we look at the 2025 to 2030 timeframe, there's two types of advanced nuclear reactors that we expect to be deployed commercially. On the bottom there, small modular reactors, they're defined as less than 300 megawatts electric in capacity. The timeline for those right now, we expect the NRC to approve the first design by this September 2020. And current plans right now are for the first reactor to be operational in the 2026 timeframe. That would be at the Idaho National Laboratory owned by the UAMPS utility, and it would be a commercial reactor. The other near-term type of advanced reactor are called micro-reactors. These are 1 to 10 megawatts in size and are being designed to be deployed in remote areas. These could be mining operations, defense facilities, or even remote villages. They can produce heat in addition to the power. The first operating license application was submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission just this week, and based on conversations we've had with the NRC, the regulator, we expect that they may review that application within 2 years. That reactor would be a demonstration reactor operational around the 2023 timeframe. With commercial deployments, it could be around 2026. Microreactor development and deployment is faster than other advanced reactors because of the very, very small size that allows for that. Further on in time, we expect other advanced non-light water reactors to be available. Moving on to slide three. The key point here that advanced reactors are expected to be cost competitive. This graph is from a report NEI issued last year that looked at the costs of micro reactors and the current generating costs in several markets. The current generating costs are typically diesel generators, and it was just estimated as the fuel cost and transportation of that fuel. What you'll see is a large range in the cost for micro reactors. This accounts for differences in designs and locations. But the two key takeaways here is that even at the highest cost that we expect, We see that microreactors can be competitive in some areas, and that would be remote Arctic communities there. And even better, if they come out at the lower cost, these could be competitive in many, many markets around the country and on islands as well. Not shown here are the cost of small modular reactors. Those are intended for the grid, and therefore they're expected to be competitive with generating cost of new generation in the lower 48 grid market. That's in the 5 to 6 cents per kilowatt range. Moving on to slide four, the key point here is that Senate Bill 194 is critical for Alaska to attract advanced reactors. In the private investment, there's been over $1 billion of private capital spent on developing many advanced reactor designs. Many of these companies that are developing advanced reactors have decided to do that because they see nuclear as the answer to reducing carbon emissions and improving the standard of living. They're being supported, many of them, with federal support, whether it's in the R&D, design and licensing, or in demonstrations. The states and nationally, we see action from many states that are considering legislation to welcome new nuclear into their states. One example is Idaho, where they've passed resolutions and tax incentives for new nuclear, and that happens to be the state where there's an ongoing project in the works. All of these actions are strong indicators that help states stand out as advanced reactor companies begin to think about their target markets. The Alaska bill is important in that it is an indicator to business that Alaska is open for business and welcoming to advanced reactors. It also reduces unnecessary barriers that create uncertainty and business risk, which provide a disincentive to investment. With that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nickel. Questions for Mr. Nickel?
Brief one.
Senator Cargill.
So the first application, I guess application is the best word I can come up with, is before the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. How long does it take for something like that to go through the commission? You said 2 years.
Historically, it's taken about 3 years for the NRC to review an application. That's consistent with the one that we expect to be approved in September. What we find for microreactors, because they're much smaller and simpler, there's less information for the NRC to review, and so they can perform their review much more quickly. So we're expecting a 2-year review for microreactors.
Senator Coghill?
From my experience, and you can tell me if my experience is wrong, they are almost all geared towards large reactors. Can they make the shift, and do they have now the mindset where they can go into this different kind of project?
Mr. Nickel?
Yes, you are correct that the regulations and their experience is based on large light water reactors. They've been preparing for advanced reactor designs for several years now. They've been getting special funding from Congress to be able to prepare for the review of advanced reactors, and we believe that they're ready. They've addressed several technical issues where advanced reactors are slightly different from the previous large light water reactors, and so there's been a lot of work on the NRC side to prepare them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Was remiss in mentioning Senator Coghill, I think, joined us at 3:45 p.m., so thank you for being here. Other questions for Mr. Grusendorf or Mr. Nickel? We are out of time, so Gwen Holdman, we're going to bring you back next time, if that's okay. And I think, do you have anything else you'd like to say before we adjourn today?
I appreciate you letting us introduce the bill.
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Grusendorf. I'm also going to open public testimony. just so we're open for next time. And please send any written testimony on this bill to the committee email at sres@aklag.gov. Seeing no one else that is here today to testify on the bill and no one online other than Gwen Holdman that we'll bring back, we'll put this aside. I want to thank our LIO moderator, Nate Williams, and Chris Dickrell with Senate Records, as well as my staff, Conrad Jackson, for all of your hard work. And as there's no further business to come before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 5 p.m.